Hi, my name is Lucy Shackelford, and I am the research editor at the Washington Post. Several months ago, I vaguely remember Derek coming up to me and asking if I would introduce him at the SLA conference. I also vaguely remember accepting the offer, though wondered why he needed an introduction at all. Lots of people know who Derek Willis is. What I'm quite certain about is when he asked me, he certainly didn't tell me his session began at 7:30 in the morning. So I am very glad that all of you showed up. There are a few other things that I'm quite certain about when it comes to Derek. One, though I didn't hire him as research database editor at the Washington Post, I do know that since he was hired at the Post, I've learned something new from him almost every day he's been there. Thankfully, he's quite good at his job, and he's quite good at making researchers think in a different way, to see things in research outside the box. I also know that he has an incredible gift of gab, and that makes early morning sessions like this much more interesting. And finally, I know he loves a challenge. He challenges the way researchers think and how we work in the newsroom, which is another aspect which will prove interesting in this discussion. Derek prepared for a career in journalism by serving breakfast in bed to honeymooners in the Poconos, thus losing all shame. As you will soon understand only too well, he majored in rhetoric in college and then began working at the news library at the Palm Beach Post. He has worked as a reporter and database specialist at Congressional Quarterly and at the Center for Public Integrity. He came to the Washington Post as research database editor in 2004. His boss is soon leaving the paper, although Derek thinks he is probably not the cause. He has a wife and a month-old daughter, and you can find him online at thescoop.org.
Thank you very much, Lucy. If anyone after the session would like to be my boss, good luck, and you may need some more coffee or something. I'm going to probably hold this at least for a little while. I want to, before we begin, first apologize for the little bit of delay at the start. Jessica, saved me by having the right laptop with the right adapter. So, first of all, acknowledgement of our sponsor, InMagic, is sponsoring this particular session. And I also want to apologize to them because I may say some things not directly about them, but about the kind of products they make generically and other companies make that may also be a little bit bad. So I'm not knocking on them in particular, but we'll get into this a little bit later. But I am grateful that they would at least agree to sponsor my heretical statements. So. With that, let me sort of just tell you a little bit more about, while I sort of get all gussied up here, tell you a little bit more about what I do at the Post, because I'm not, as Lucy explained, I'm the research database editor, which means varying things, really. And one of the things is that I don't do a lot of what most of news researchers do in the sense of handling an individual requests, although I do handle certain things. Most of what I do involves working with databases and data and some training as well. But a lot of what I do involves working more from the data side of things. So I am heavily, you would call, data-centric. I used to like making lists as a child, and then I bought a computer, and then I found out that I didn't have to actually write lists anymore. And now I get to do all sorts of other fun things. And what I've been trying to do, both at the Post and just in general, is sort of try to expand the horizons a little bit on what it is that I think that we as news researchers can and should be doing, particularly for our newsroom. I don't think it's, I know it's early morning, and so I don't think it's too heretical, however, to say that we're not in the greatest of places many of us these days, many of our colleagues these days. We were meeting in a city that, which has a newspaper with a wonderful history, but just slashed its library staff and devoted most of the rest of them to archiving, which is not an insignificant task, but it's not also sort of troubling, at least to me, and probably to many of you. Same thing for a newspaper up the road, the Philadelphia Inquirer, another newspaper with a fabulous history and a wonderful staff that has also been sort of shunted a little bit aside. And as wonderful and as talented and as resourceful as all of us are, and many of our colleagues who aren't here are, we also have to deal with people who, and I know this is sort of, you know, both sort of hard to understand and offensive, think or can come to the realization that, well, if I can put Nexus on my reporter's desktops, what do I need some of these people for? I can save some money. That's really a tough issue to convince people on in terms of convincing bosses and management that they wouldn't save money. But I think that there are some things that we can do to do that, to sort of take that issue away and reframe it in a little bit different way. When when I thought about this presentation, I thought about, you know, sort of trying to do what I do, explain what I do at the Post, but then I also wanted to think about what, not really what I do, but what you do, because what I do is sort of unique to me at the moment, and the Post is, you know, the Post is the Washington Post. It's a really large and fairly well-funded organization. I recognize that almost none of you are in my circumstance, but here's what I think about what you all can do in your circumstances. I was at two sessions yesterday here that were very, very good and very, very heartening to me. One was the Newsroom Wiki session yesterday, where I saw a lot of cool things being done by a lot of cool people at papers of varying sizes. The second was the afternoon session with Gary Price and Gene Tversky and the new web tools. And Gary always and Gene, they always put on a good show, and they always show us some really cool things. But there's one thing that always has gnawed at me about Gary's show, and not really about Gary's show, and I love Gary, but about the concept, which is almost invariably Gary always mentions that the tools that he's showing you, many of them allow you to do things without knowing anything about databases or code. Usually makes a point of pride of saying, and you can do this without knowing anything about that kind of stuff. And I hear that, and I cringe a little bit, and I start, there's one word that appears in my mind, and that word is crutchware. Crutchware is software that you will become dependent upon. And as much of a resource as it can be, honestly, LexisNexis is crutchware, because it's how bosses will come to see it as, well, okay, well, you know, there's no magic to this, really. It's available to me, and it's available to you, so it's crutchware. There's a point in time when crutchware is useful, and that's the point in time where between Gary, when Gary Price first learns of it, and then tells you, and it's still useful up until the point that it reaches broad knowledge and awareness in your newsroom. And then crutchware becomes crutchware. And it becomes a burden, actually, because, I mean, I'm sure most of you have dealt with this at one point or another. Someone comes up to you and says, okay, I like this resource that you showed me, but I wanted to do this little thing differently, or just this little more, or I wish we could use it to do this. And we're always, almost often, left with the response, gosh, I can't make it do that for you, because I can't really take it apart. We buy the service, and that's what it is, And this is where I kind of slam InMagic a little bit for trying to sell you a product. And not just InMagic, but lots of companies that try to sell you a product that say is going to do for your newsroom what you need it to do. If I had infinite time and infinite number of monkeys, I couldn't design products that will do things exactly the way that every one of your newsrooms needs them to be done. And so, as a general rule, I kind of lean in against buying these software products that tell you that they can solve all your problems because they have designed them just for you.
because they haven't designed them just for you. They designed them for a broad enough market that they can sell enough copies of the software that they can make the product worthwhile. Just for you is going to involve a lot more work. And it's going to involve you throwing away not throwing away the crutchware, but at least having an option of getting away from the crutchware. And it's going to involve you kind of designing your own things. And to do that, God bless Gary Price, but you have to know a little bit about how the stuff works. And here's the thing about that. I'm not a programmer, by the way. I'm a geek, but I'm not a programmer. And it's my belief that almost everybody here is a geek and not a programmer as well. And there's a good thing about that, because programmers don't understand the needs of newsrooms, really. They understand the needs of, like, design documents that say X should do this and this should do this. Most of us have a very good idea of what our newsrooms need. It's just our good fortune, actually, now that we actually live in an era where we can make things that actually fulfill those needs. 10 years ago, this was a very, very difficult task. It's getting easier all the time. This is not to say that it's easy, but it's getting easier. And I want to show you a little bit about how this has evolved. Data, to me, is not just databases like our old friends from the FEC, where you get campaign finance data, and you download this database and you put it into Access or Excel or something else, and you do all these sort of things with it. That's data in one sense of the word. And that's fine. We should all be kind of at least somewhat familiar with things like spreadsheets and databases, and just sort of be comfortable enough to work with them. But they're not by in and of themselves enough to sort of make me satisfied or to really kind of fulfill the promise of data. Here, a couple months ago, I was approached by a reporter at the paper who asked me. She said, I'm covering, and again, this is a luxury that the Washington Post really sort of has occasionally, I'm covering the Pillsbury Bake Off. That's not a beat, by the way, but but her question to me was, I want to know if these recipes are substantively different from recipes that won in the 1950s, the 60s, the 70s, and 80s. Well, there's a lot more fat. And that's actually demonstrably true. You can prove that. And the reason you can prove that is that if you say, not to pick on Kathy McManzigal of Monterey, California, but if you click on her taco steak pasta, you see how the ingredients are listed? That's data. And it's data because for two things. One is it's in front of you, but second of all, it's because it's in HTML, because it's on a web page, it's marked up. And for those of you who love doing view source, and come on, we all love doing view source. You'll see, and if you don't, you should get used to it. You'll see that actually it follows a structure. It follows their tags around it. It's not as bad as HTML, but it's not as clean as XML necessarily is sometimes. But it can be sort of parsed, and so literally, I drummed up something that actually went out and visited all these web pages with recipes, ran all the recipes and ingredients in, and you could tell her that in the history of the Pillsbury Bake Off contest, no winning recipe, none, has had peanut butter. Not one, ever. Which I think is a really big travesty of justice. But then we thought about why that might be, and it didn't make it in the article, actually. It's just really kind of sad. I think the thing was the kids and the allergies and the peanuts and this. Yeah, I think Pillsbury has this anti-peanut thing going on. You would never know that looking recipe by recipe, though. And if you treated these as web pages rather than as data, you wouldn't know it. Now, I'm not going to kid you and say, oh, this took me 5 minutes to do, and I also made a cup of coffee while I was doing it. No, I mean, it took a little while to do, but the point is that it's doable. And there's so much that is doable. Other things about data.
this is one thing that... Let me go back here a little bit. This is another thing that bugs me about Washington, D.C., those of you who live in the area, is we have a pretty good metro system, subway system, but occasionally things just happen where it just kind of breaks, or things happen where there's a delay in a train and you don't know why and they don't really tell you, and you can't really figure out what's going on. Metro, in a pretty impressive attempt at transparency for them, started posting last year a list of service disruptions anytime a train was delayed at least 4 minutes or longer. Now, they posted these on their website, and they posted them, there's one page for every day, and then it lists all these service disruptions, which actually is a pretty handy resource if you have the time to page through all the pages and find out what, the, you know, this and that and the other. There's no search function for this. You can't, on their site, if you're just using this as their site, you can't really do anything with it. It is, in the worst sense of the term, crutchware. Because they're saying, oh, here's a resource for you, but it's not helpful. Not really. So I was pretty wholly unsatisfied with that. And I thought, okay, that is just not a way to make it useful. But it is data, and it can be made useful. Oh, come on. Really? So again, what I did was I wrote a little program to go out. When I say I'm not a programmer, but I wrote a little program to go out and visit these web pages and take out each of these descriptions and shove them in the database. So it has the date and the time, and then it has the description. And then from the description, it follows a fairly common syntax. It usually says an inbound or outbound green line train or whatever line train. And so from that phrase, line train, you can get the line, pluck that out, put it into another field of the database. The station usually follows. It's a very common pattern in the syntax. Pluck that out. And what you get eventually is a database that has a little bit of, that's a little bit more useful. So for instance, here's the database through Sundays, through Sundays incidents. Today won't be posted until about 11 o'clock or noon. Yesterday won't be posted until about noon today because WMATA, you know, they have work to do in the morning, I guess. But here, what you get is you can find, for instance, all the latest incidents, the last 10 or so, but you can also browse them by date or by line, by station, by the category, which I've been trying to apply a little bit of logic to. So you can say, like, okay, well, on Sunday, here are the incidents that they reported. And you can go back and say, okay, well, here's, let's go to Eisenhower Avenue for this. Okay, so here's one of my favorite ones, the overrunning the platform issue. Washington, D.C. has an automated system. They overrun the platform platform overruns account for, out of the 3,000 incidences in our database, they account for 485 of them. So about a sixth of the time, these automated trains overrun the platform. We're going to write about this. Because it's kind of a story. But you would never know that if all you did was visited the WMATA site and look every day. I mean, if you were really, really good, you could kind of, after a while, figure out that there was a pattern going on here. But not in the way that you can figure it out here. Oh, and we also, for our, you know, math challenge reporters, automatically put in, it's been one day and 11 hours since the last incident on the Eisenhower Avenue station. And again, all this stuff is automated. The beauty of doing stuff this way is that all I have to do to update this database is make sure my computer is plugged in. That's it. It's an automatic job. It runs every morning, like around noon or so. It goes out, fetches the script, fetches the stuff, throws it in the database.
And this is a web application framework system, which sounds fancy, but it's not. It just sort of is templates and it flows right in. And so the real beauty of it is that you think, okay, well, this is great, Derek, but I don't have the time to do this. I don't certainly have time to devote to keeping this up. The time that I devote to keeping this up is less than 5 minutes a day, and usually less than that. And so I can build this and automate it and then leave it alone. And until WMATA decides that they're going to change their website around, I don't have to do anything to keep this updated. I have a constantly updated database that just works. And I think that if you look around your newsrooms, your cities, your counties, you'll find lots and lots of government agencies in particular doing stuff like this, or rather putting data online that can be used in this way. But generally speaking, they don't want to make it easy for you to do some sort of embarrassing analysis such as, by the way, our automated system doesn't really work. They don't want to tell you that, so you're going to have to do a little digging to find it out on your own. By the way, my personal favorite, I think, well, it's tied between Presidential Motorcade. They stopped the motorcade. Give you an idea here. I'm sorry for the diversion, but the orange line runs in between, in the median of Route 66, which is an interstate highway in Northern Virginia. They stopped the train so that the motorcade could go past on 66. The train does not run on the road, the motorcade does not run on the tracks, but it stopped twice. The other one, and this is my all-time favorite, operator lockdown. The driver closed the door to his car. Well, Metro will never send out a press release about this. But, you know, it happened in April. And I bet you we could probably find the poor staff it happened. Not that you would necessarily do that, but if a reporter comes to you and says, a guy got locked out of, Metro Rider got locked out of his car today, when's the last time that happened? Well, I know. And everybody knows. So, why not? And that's the other real benefit to me of doing these kind of sort of deep databases that are in particular are browsable. Nothing against the mantra that we've been teaching about searching, because that's something that is not only critical but vital. But frankly, how many years have we been training our reporters to be good searchers, and how many of them would you actually depend your life upon to find something if you had, like, you know, one thing to find, which, you know, be like, yeah, I'll get it myself, thanks. You wouldn't, you know, and so searching is good if you have great searchers. But we're the great searchers. Let them browse. Don't let them search. At least don't let them search too much. Because they get lost and they complain and then it's all, you know. And so, the other example of this, I showed you a little bit, I mentioned briefly the Federal Election Commission database. And they have not only, you know, campaign contributions and expenditures, but they also have summary data. And one of the questions we get asked a lot, and Lucy probably gets this even more than I do, is how much cash on hand does, you know, Senator so-and-so have at this moment of time, and his opponents and the rest of it. And it's a waste of time for us to look this up. It's an insult, really. It's a waste of time. Because for one thing, the FEC actually sort of provides this. It's just that it's really, really, really unhelpful and hard to find and annoying. Annoying to find. So, and you'll notice, by the way, if you notice a similar design here, that's because I'm not artistically inclined at all. And if I find something that is mildly pleasing to the eye, I'll stick with it until that cold grip finally removes me. But here, for instance, is this. Again, is a database that is updated as long as my computer is on at 11 o'clock in the morning. Because I know when the FEC updates their data, and it's right before 11 o'clock in the morning. And so then I have a little script that goes out, gets the data file, and then updates the database. And so you can look at candidates by state. I can see the top 25 in terms of cash on hand. And then you can see, okay, well, Bill Nelson. Okay, Florida. Who's Bill Nelson running against? okay, here's Bill Nelson's cash on hand and basic statistics. And I go, oh, see other candidates for this office. Oh, it's Catherine. Oh, right, Catherine. Okay, that'll be a fundraise. If you have $3 million cash on hand, you're in trouble. When your opponent has 10, that's not good. Even if your name isn't Catherine Harris. But the point here is that the FEC already provides this data, and it already provides this data online. But seeing as how we keep getting the questions from reporters, how much cash on hand does so-and-so have, clearly, either they don't, they're unable somehow to actually acknowledge that the FEC provides this resource, they're unwilling to use it, they don't know how, or I don't really know what the other answer is. I mean, but so here's a slightly better way for them to do that. And this way, they just have to click around a little bit, and they can see things, and they're all on the same page. The FEC designs information, you know, they're probably one of the best agencies out there in terms of public disclosure, and even so, they're kind of annoying to navigate the website. It's not very, you know, they don't think the way that reporters think a lot of times, or browse the way they browse, or look for information the way that reporters do. And so the more that we can do to actually limit the number of times that they come back and say, I know you're busy, but I just have this one thing that'll take like 3 seconds. And then you're like, yeah, but you're the 50th person that said that today, and now it's, you know, past noon, and you know, it just, the more that we can do to kind of offload their own work onto, you know, them, I think the better off we are. But not only the better off we are, but then you can go and say, I mean, like, the thing about stuff like the products like this is that, and you know, I guess I should kind of be a little bit subconscious about this around, but I don't apologize for going and showing all, you know, every boss I can find, hey, we've got this thing here. The one thing that I kind of cringed at yesterday in the Newsroom Wiki thing was the presentation was the bit where they said, well, it's just the researchers that are doing this. No. Get out there. And don't get out there like the whole, you know, you don't have to get out there and say, you know, force everyone in the newsroom to visit your wiki. Because clearly there are some people who aren't going to do that, and who do, or who are going to and go, I don't understand what this is, goodbye. But there are people out there who will be champions for you, and some of them are extraordinarily unlikely. When we started using wikis at the Washington Post, there are people who I thought, no way, just no way. I don't know whether you realize this, but some of our reporters at the Washington Post are, you know, I mean, they're at the top of their game, and the Pulitzer winners. And so telling them what to do isn't really part of the plan. But even some of those folks, I would show it to, and I was astonished by some of them who actually use it. Now, some of them requested that I have the wiki be a really hideous blue color because that's what they preferred. But you know what? If you're going to use it, it'll be polka dot and spotted if you want, as long as you use the darn thing. So find people in your newsroom who will use it. Doesn't have to be everybody, but find people and find them early on. And it's even better, I think, it's been better for us, I think, to find people who are acknowledged as like leaders and people of some influence in the newsroom in terms of like, hey, that person used it, and I want to do that too. Because that's happened at the Post, where we've had people come up and say, I've had people come up to me and say, sort of, you know, surreptitiously, I heard this wiki thing. Can I get one of those? And this is the point where you realize sort of how, what kind of influence librarians have, researchers have, in the cloud ops. And if you keep a straight enough face, I've actually had one person actually begin from their pants. No, really, it's fine. But because word of mouth will travel within a newsroom, we know how fast stuff travels within a newsroom, don't we? But so, you know, you find a couple of champions, you get to use this stuff, and all of a sudden you have people coming to you and saying, I want to use these things, teach me how to use these things, and even better, like, I want to use it for something really, really important. We have kind of taken, when it comes to using wikis, a slightly different tack than some of the things that we saw yesterday. One of those is that we use it a lot more for projects. for reporters, a single reporter, or usually two or more reporters at a time. And that's good and that's bad. And the good part about it is that once they start using it, they quickly become addicted to it. They realize that all their stuff is in the wiki, and therefore they have to use it. And that's a good sort of self-reinforcing thing, and you want to sort of encourage that. The bad thing is that almost immediately after they realize that they are addicted to it, they come to you and say, please restrict access to this wiki. Put a password on it. We use a program called, this is it, in Sticky. I don't know why they name all these, but the marketing folks out in WikiLand are not really up to par. But in Sticky, you can have any number of wikis on a single installation, and you can password protect some or none or all. Most of ours are password protected. This annoys me, but I do it, and the reason I do it, and the reason I actually encourage people to do it, is because even though it's password protected, I have the password, but I know that I'd rather have it be password protected now, because reporters being reporters, they're going to do their project, and they're going to move on, and at some point, you can go back to them and say, hey, this the wiki you guys set up, how about we, you treat it like a classification, declassification process. You know, after a period of time, you can go to the reporters and say, okay, this goes into the public domain. That's the price of using the wiki. And I've, talked to some about that, and we're kind of moving in that direction, and I'll give them first right of refusal over, okay, yes, but this section of the, wiki can't be, I don't want it to be available to the entire newsroom. But they're going to move on. And you can benefit, and I know that even though a lot of it's password protected now, there's going to come a time when a lot of it won't be, where I can just remove the password and people can see it. And so at least while they're in their, still in their paranoia phase, I'm still collecting everything they do, and I have it. And they don't even realize that's why I'm doing it. And so they're helping me and helping the rest of the newsroom without really knowing that they're doing so, because if you explain it to them in those terms, they probably wouldn't do it. At least we probably would get some resistance at the Post by saying, oh, this is a something that will benefit the entire newsroom. And they'll be like, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to benefit the entire newsroom. Some principles that I've already talked a little bit about crutchware and sort of the perils of following along with that. Never turn down data. Even if you don't actually use it or use it right away, or you put it to the side, never ever turn down data. If someone offers to give you data, take it. Just take it. By all means, take it. Because you never know. The person who offers it to you might leave their job, and the next person will not be so forthcoming. So, never turn down. Steal from the best. Steal from the best is pretty simple, and that's like my graphic skills are stolen from other people. What I mean by that is not literally steal information, but literally steal the best ideas and just copy them and use them, because particularly on an intranet, you're not going to get a whole lot of copyright issues and people aren't going to complain a whole lot because they're never going to see what you're doing. So steal good ideas. The most important of these, though, is the automate and DRY. Anyone knows what DRY stands for? It's a programming term. This is the one sort of programming section. It's don't repeat yourself. And this is, to me, the whole key about it. Because if you're going to build, if you're in charge, or if you're thinking about building up resources in your newsroom, databases and things like that, and you think, okay, well, each database I make, I own, and I have to maintain, and pretty soon, let's say I was spending an hour a week on doing this, and pretty soon that's going to be 5 hours a week and 10 hours a week, and then pretty soon I don't do the job I used to do, and my boss isn't happy about that. And that's a very, that's a very slippery slope, and it goes downhill real quickly. But if you know you're going to do something more often than than not, daily, weekly, monthly, whatever, take the time to learn how to automate that process, because it'll save you time in the back end, but also it'll give you the ability to work on other things. Doing the Metro database and the FEC database that way took me a little extra time on the front end, but they work now basically in perpetuity. And that's a pretty good deal that I would take every single time. Automating the process when you can is very, very
is a very good pick. Deploy first. Mike Myers, who spoke yesterday at the newsroom review section, I thought was great, put it great. I didn't really get my IT department involved because I just put it on a box that I had and started it up. Do that. Do that a lot. You may come to annoy your IT department, but I found the best way to sort of prevent against that is to deploy something really cool or useful, and then you ask for forgiveness later. Because if it's really cool, your boss is not going to say to you, God, that's cool, now get rid of it. And if they do, then that doesn't happen very often.
At least in my experience,
if you have something that's pretty cool and useful, and you already have it done, then they're going to find a way to make it work in your newsroom. They're not going to be like, oh, well, we have to do this and that and the other. So deploy first, ask permissions later.
A little bit about the never turn down data.
Yeah.
At what point do you start giving you data, and what kind of data is it?
Well,
is it when they see you have these tools where you can store this data?
Well, that's one thing. I often tell reporters, if you want to ask for data, I'll be happy to be the receptacle for it. And again, it's a way of sort of aggregating for a broader use. Rather than me having to figure out who has what around the newsroom. If a reporter comes to me and says, I'm interested in getting this data, I'll say, fine, have them send it to me, and I'll make it available to you. The other thing is chances are almost all of us work at organizations where data is already running through our newsrooms like a train every day, except it also leaves the newsroom every day or every week. Crime data is a big one. Property sales. We often already, or some of us are probably already involved in collecting this stuff so that it gets printed in our papers or published on the website, and then it just kind of drops through the floor and continues on its way. And we have this problem at the Post right now. We set up this process by which we get crime data from a couple of the suburban counties around D.C., and we actually have some of the newsroom employees process it so that it can be published in the paper and then on the website, and you don't really do anything with it, which is dumb. And not just dumb, but you're actually losing the ability to, you're losing a resource there. It's sort of like you're leaving the tap on all day and going, off, and just, you're going to pay for that because you're making the data available and someone's going to figure it out in terms of how to use it. What you don't want is you don't want to wake up one day and, if you're, I don't know how many of you have seen this site, chicagocrime.org. Anyway, folks from Chicago or near Chicago? Okay. This is a guy who actually works for us from Chicago. But he did this in his spare time because the Chicago Police Department has a web server where they put their crime data on. And it was very clunky, and it had a really horrible search interface, and nobody used it, and he thought, I need to be done better. And did it in his spare time, and now it's really, really staggeringly popular. And not to mention it got him lots of jobs. But beyond that, what you don't want, if you're like, say, Chicago Tribune, is to wake up one day and see that some 24-year-old kid has trumped you in terms of aggregating and presenting data that's been in your newsroom for years. It boggles the mind that you would be like, I guess we should have done that. But the thing about it is there are lots of kids out there with time on their hands that are going to do stuff like this, and they're going to make us look a little silly. This is already occurring for us. There's a guy who essentially took this idea, stole it from the Best, and applied it to Fairfax County. Which is our largest jurisdiction, population-wise, in our circulation area. And there's a site that maps crimes using Google Maps and the publicly available crime data that Fairfax County posts. And, we know about it. Of course, we're not going to really publicize it because, why would we? It makes us look bad. But it's out there, and people are going to do that sort of thing, and they're going to kind of draw away from, from our websites and from our papers, and it's not a good thing. So there's often a lot of kinds of data that are in the newsroom. The other thing that I also like to say about data is that, like the Pillsbury Bake Off issue, there's data where you don't even think there's data, but anything that can be observed or measured can be data. And so just kind of
think of ways that you can do stuff with it. Be an evangelist.
After I got my job at the Post, I thought, maybe I should tack that on my title. That would be cool, evangelist. And there are people who have the job of evangelist, non-religious job of evangelist.
Apple's a religion.
Right. Apple computer is a religion, exactly. That's a very good point. And I actually am acolyte, I think, of that. But being an evangelist in terms of don't be shy about prodding people to say, we need to think about where our data is and how we're using it and whether or not we're actually using it for good or whether we're just wasting it. It takes a certain amount of shamelessness, which, as Lizzie explained to you, I lost shame in the Poconos. But you have to do this. You have to go around and say, no, I'm sorry. You're doing, stop doing that thing badly and look at this and use this. Because this is at least better. It's not perfect, but it's at least better. And what kills me sometimes about our community is that if I gave any one of you guys said it came into the newsroom at 5 o'clock and said, I have to find this person. I have to talk to them tonight for the story that's going on the front page. Most of you would probably push small children under a train to get that done. You would take it as a personal challenge. You'd be like, I have to do this, and you'll be aggressive and fairly ruthless as far as librarianship goes to do the job. But we won't be ruthless about making sure that people know what we're doing or insisting that they use the wiki because, damn it, they should use the wiki. There's got to be a little more of that. The quieter we are, the more likely we end up like our colleagues in Baltimore and Philadelphia. And I just believe that firmly because otherwise, there's no impression. You leave no impression. They'll form their own impressions about what it is that we do and the value of it. So, I mean, of course, this is easy for me to say. I talk a lot anyway. But and it fits, Oh, sure, talk a lot like Derek. But honestly, I can't imagine, I can't imagine looking around and seeing a lot of the great work that's done and saying, we know about it, but other people may not know about it, and that's just wrong. Just to sort of give you an example, it was very, very, and Lucy was there with the Post. Did pretty well with those Pulitzer things this year, apparently, and at the announcements in the newsroom, which is like a huge celebration and things like that, and balloons and cake and elephants, and the people, most of the folks who won, singled out researchers for their work by name, and this was kind of an impressive thing, but honestly, knowing what I know about my colleagues at the Post, it's a long time coming, and the only reason or one of the main reasons it's not that way is because we really don't sort of leap up and demand it, and we probably ought to a little more often than not. Okay, take a brief pause there. Any questions so far about sort of crap that I've talked about and things? Yes.
Are you writing scripts in Ruby or
what? He's a plant, ladies and gentlemen. No. what I use, and because I was just sort of getting into how I do what I do. What I use is I use a scripting language called Python. I use Python not because, one, a couple reasons. One is that it was named after Monty Python's plant. How much better can you get? The other reason I use it is the couple reasons. One, it's not. There are a lot of little languages out there that I've worked that you can do stuff in. You can do stuff in Visual Basic. Some of you probably have seen a little Visual Basic or JavaScript and things that in dealing with your intranet or dealing with Microsoft Access occasionally. Python is my choice because one, it's in English, which is a big plus. the whole curly brace thing and French bracket that seem to like be like every third character of other programming languages. Just, I'm sorry, I didn't take a math class in college. It's not me. So it's in English. And also, it runs everywhere, and it works with just about everything. And by that, I mean, it hooks into any kind of database pretty much. It works with web servers really well. It just works. It's very fast, and it works just really well. I should mention that the summary stats, the FEC database that we have, and also the Metro database that we have, they all run on Python. They all run using a framework created by the guy who did that Chicago crime site. And for those of you, anyone here from the Scripps Howard papers? Okay. Your websites are pretty much, well, most of your chain's websites are about to be converted to another system, content management system underneath that is run on top of this, Django. This is a Python framework, and it is designed by a friend of mine, Adrian, now works at the Washington Post, but when he was at the Lawrence Journal World in Kansas, and we've probably seen like the stories about like Lawrence Journal World and how like, you know, the coolest stuff ever, and web things, and quite frankly, a lot of it is very, very cool. And they essentially designed this sort of framework for, in particular, newspaper websites. But also just do cool things with data, like that Chicago crime site. And so, for instance, if you write a Scripps Howard paper, you're pretty soon probably going to have essentially access to the framework that runs those kind of sites. And this is where you need to kind of, if you don't already, you need to kind of talk to your web people a lot. Because, quite frankly, the one other way to get around IT, newsroom IT, is to deploy stuff on the web. And if you have something that's really cool, the website, if they're smart, they're not going to say no to it. And in fact, if they're really smart, and not enough of them are, they probably should have found you already and said, hey, what do you guys have? Because apparently, you guys sit on all the information in the newsroom. Our website is kind of learning this still, but that's probably because they're located in another state, and in D.C., across the river in Virginia, and we see them every once in a while, but, you know. Sometimes it's better. But I use this Django framework and Python, and the other thing I use an awful lot is a database called MySQL. I should mention, by the way, that every single thing I'm going to show to you, as far as the tools that I use, one, I do have a handout that I'll give you the web one for later on, but all of it is free. And by free, I mean free as in beer. You don't pay for it unless you like need like support or, you know, I mean, and not even like support, because I've never actually paid for support for MySQL in 4 years of using it, because there's a lot of good documentation or training and things like that. But everything I show you is free, freely available, and in fact open source, which means you can tinker with it. For those folks who aren't really familiar with the whole kind of open source thing, open source is an incredible gift to newsrooms in particular because, again, not to bash the folks that didn't manage the other software, but the software they sell you can't really change unless you go to them and what? Pay them money and ask them to do it. Okay, that's crutchable. If you have to rely on someone else to do the things that you want to do, that's crutchable. If I want to change something, about the way that MySQL works, or about the way that that framework, that Django framework works, I can do that. No problem. No money. I can just do it. So there's a real big advantage to newsrooms in particular using it. MySQL is my database. Apache usually is the web server. And here's the, although there are other good web servers, but most folks Apache is pretty easy to get to, at least usually you have it somewhere in your newsroom. If you're all Microsoft shop, you may have Microsoft IIS, an Internet Information Server, which also works. Not a bad web server. But the cool thing is that a lot of these little applications and things that I use, Python, that is Sticky, I showed you our little wiki, they come with their own web servers. Because Geeks these days, it's all about the portability and flexibility and customizability. And if I don't have to rely on someone else's web server, great. So InSticky actually runs on its own. Literally, the site for InSticky says it's like a three-step download and installation procedure. Actually, no. There is no step three. It's pretty amazing. It's just two steps. You download, and then you run. And that's it. I mean, literally, that's it. There's no hidden thing. There's no big surprise. It's free, and it runs. It comes with its own web server built in. So even if your IT department is populated, you know, is run by folks who believe that, it, you know, the more often you touch the keyboard, like, Rome will fall, the empire will crumble. You know, even this, you can get around this. Now, I have some friends who, and I've actually worked at places where literally they don't get to install anything. Does anyone here work at a place where you don't get to install anything? Yeah. And that's just, I mean, essentially that's sort of like going out for a bullfight with your hand tied behind, one hand tied behind your back. And people need to, you know, I mean, I'm sure you do complain about that, but that is a serious, serious disarmament policy. And it, you know, it is akin to sending reporters out without the notebook, without the pens. I mean, it is a very bad idea. So, in addition to just sort of griping about it, there are other things you can do. One of my favorite things to do is something that my colleague Matt Wade at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida does. When he has something that he wants to do with his computer that his IT folks won't let him do, he does it on his own web server that he bought space from. You know, it's an internet account provider. He puts it up on the internet. And then goes in and shows his boss. He says, you have two options here. You can either give me the ability to do this inside the building, or we'll run it outside, and, you know, somebody may stumble upon it. Who knows? It's a big internet out there.
Derek, I'm John Martin from the St. Pete Times, and I actually was in a session with Matt where he demonstrated to our slightly Luddite IT staff how his wiki worked so that we could get a new wiki in the process of getting down.
And
we've never gotten a good lot on our IT staff.
Right. They're not going to, because IT staff's job is to prevent bad things from happening. All of you are doers of bad things. So sometimes you have to go and say, look, if this is what you're going to give me to work with, this is what I'm going to have to do in response. And I've done this at previous organizations. Thankfully, the Post has been very, very kind to me in terms of being lenient for when I kill things like servers and occasionally. But other organizations, I had to do the exact same thing. I've had to show people, like, oh, and where is this? Oh, it's on the internet. It's available to anybody. And in fact, I might link to it because I'm kind of proud of my work. And they're like, quick, go, go. But the thing is we should all be developers of one kind or another. We may not be software developers. We may never program, even in Python. But we should be developers. We should be developing things. And the only way that you can develop stuff is if you control your own box. So if you control your own box, even if it's not your newsroom box, your box at home, tinker. Do stuff. Because innovation just doesn't sort of like, you can't buy it out of a pre-wrapped software box. You kind of actually have to do things. And the more that you do things, the more likely you are to hit upon something that is really, really kind of cool and useful. But I'm never, never afraid to, you know, say to somebody, look, I want to do this. I could do this, but there's a roadblock. And so either I'm going to go around the roadblock or you're going to remove the roadblock, and we can proceed one of two ways, pretty much. But this needs to get done. There are also a bunch of other really fun tools that I've either spoken about or written about occasionally or talked about. Again, continuing on the free the free theme. XPDF, for those of you who hate PDFs, if you do not hate PDFs, you should. Make no mistake, Adobe wants you to live in a PDF world. They want you to only open PDFs, to not open other documents. And they want you to never remove any document out of a PDF form. This is their goal. I mean, that's how they make money. And I'm not begrudging them their money, but it's bad for us. Because PDFs are visually stunning and practically useless. So, this fellow, whose first name is also Derek, by total coincidence, wrote a package, software package, that takes electronic PDFs and removes the text from them. And in doing so, makes a pretty valiant attempt to preserve the layout, which is the really key thing. For those of us who ever tried to use the Save As feature, or whoever tried to like copy and paste from a PDF, that's a lot of fun, right? XPDF does that intentionally. Don't kid yourself. I mean, don't think that, oh, they must have overlooked that. No. They didn't overlook that. They did that so you would never do it again. I mean, this is what economists live on incentives. I mean, they made it horrible enough for you to copy and paste so that you would not choose to do it again. This helps with that sort of thing. Also helps is buying Adobe's professional version if you have that in your newsroom. If you don't have that in your newsroom, or you don't know you have that in your newsroom, find a graphic artist in your newsroom. They probably have it. And, you know, buy them cake or something, whatever's necessary for you to be able to use it, because that actually comes in handy with enormously large electronic PDFs.
The other thing I often get asked in the newsroom, and I bet you guys do too, increasingly, is I get asked about, I need to mirror this website.
You know, I need to download a whole copy of this website. And there are software programs out there. Gary Price mentioned one yesterday, HT Tracker, and some other ones. And they try to like make it so you have a nice little GUI that you can click through, and you know, it's all a step process. But remember this, when you use programs to do tasks where someone else has designed the interface, you are bound by what they let you do, ultimately. You are not free to do whatever it is you want. And in this case, wget, which works on the beautiful command line, and that's the DOS prompt for those of you on Windows, and the terminal line on Apple, does all sorts of really, really cool things. And give you an example of sort of the fun stuff you can do with wget. Oh, wait, that's the other one. Wget does instant sort of recursive downloads, which means you feed it one URL and it gets everything that's on that site. That's pretty nice and handy. When people come and say, oh, I need a mirror to this website, I go, okay, it's going to be a long job. And then I hit wget and do the recursive download, and then I go off and get a beverage. The other thing it'll do is it'll do, for instance, it'll grab particular kinds of files or only particular kinds of files. It will it can work with FTP sites. It can write its progress to a log and tell you if it had trouble finding certain files or if they weren't there. It can, if you're, you know, somebody puts a backcode to your T1 connection while it's working, it'll, once the service is back up, it'll resume its download. I mean, it's a very great. Essentially, this is the thing that all the GUI interface program, download programs, have tried to emulate since it first came out. Wget's been around for years. And all the programs like HT Track and other things are basically just sort of trying to do what it can do. You can specify only certain files. I had to do this the other day for 34,000 JPEGs. On a directory that had a lot of other files in it, I only wanted the JPEGs. And if you think about like doing that manually, that's really bad. But wget enables that with one little command line switch, and you just go with that. So it's another thing that's free, and you can just download and try out. You will need sort of, I will say about wget in particular, because it's the only one of these that is really sort of a weird thing, is that there is specifically a wget for Windows, because it was originally intended, built as a Unix and Linux utility. But there is a specific build for Windows that works very well for those of you in the Windows environment. The other things that I want to mention were, let me make sure I have my list of the other things I wanted to mention here.
And I'll be happy to entertain questions as well. Hint, hint. Let's see. Okay.
The folks yesterday mentioned MediaWiki for Wiki software. It was another free software. MediaWiki requires a database backend. They use MySQL by default. The thing about InSticky that I showed you earlier is that the earlier versions of InSticky do not require a database by default. And so that can be a help to those of you who are under like an evil, watchful eye of the department of don't do that. Because literally, think about this. This is a wiki program, a fully functioning wiki program that requires nothing, basically. It does not require a web server. It does not require a database. It requires you to actually install it, and that's it. And that, I mean, for those of us who are really captive audiences at newsrooms, these are the kind of things that can really sort of start to get the ball rolling, to get your folks to open up a little bit more. Yes?
So far, I've been great listening to you. This is wonderful. At this point, I start to get confused.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more I understand this, the better I'm going to be talking to my IT people. And then I will be like their peers.
Yeah, well, you have to be careful about being their peers.
Really.
Well,
and then,
you want to be conversant.
Right.
But you got to realize that a lot of this is diplomacy. And by diplomacy, I mean like bluster, usually.
Right. Okay, so where do I go and learn this so I get comfortable with it and then I can talk about it and be conversant?
First thing you should do is if you have we all have the copious free time. I just mentioned I have a month-old daughter now, so I have a lot of spare time right now. You should try installing this stuff at home. And just playing around with it. Go to the WGET and use the manual and just literally type out like the demonstrations of what, you know, and see what they do. And then, and just then try to use it for things that are more useful to you. Same thing with XPDF. Try it out. Do the little demos. See how it works. See how it doesn't work sometimes or how things get complicated. But I would say that if you can install it at work and you have the time there, then yeah, that's great. But if you can't, have your little development box wherever you can do it. The database stuff, the web server stuff, this is where it probably helps to find somebody who either has access to this kind of stuff already in the newsroom or can help make that possible. Some of that time, part of the time, it's the IT department. Anyone here work on Macs, like sort of the majority of the time? A handful. If you work on a Mac the majority of the time and it's running the OS X, the new sort of version software, you have Apache already, you have Python already, and Perl and PHP and a bunch of other languages. You have most of the utilities. You probably don't have WGET, or you can download that. You already have a lot of the stuff that you need to get started. And the good thing about the Mac is that Mac system administrators are a little less totally paranoid than Windows system administrators, because the Windows system administrators are constantly looking over their shoulder and waiting for bad, really, really bad things to happen. The other thing is that the Mac system administrators are generally a little more permissive about, like, in my experience, it's been about, okay, I need this, so, all right, we'll install it for you or have you install it, and that's, you know, with Windows, installation itself can be an act of treachery, so that can be a little, but literally the way I learned this stuff was just fooling around with it. I did take a class in the basic computer language in 1990. Yeah, that was my last computer class. That was my first and last computer class. All the stuff that I learned, I've stolen from lots of good people, and people online or people who put up helpful document, websites of documentation, email. When I first stumbled on XPDF, I had a question about it. I emailed the developer, and he emailed me back. I was like, cool. Now, try sending an email to Microsoft and Excel and let me know when they get back to you. Actually, let me know when they get back to you. That's where it's not like either you have to pay or they ask you to upgrade first. So there are a lot of sort of friendly people out there, and the whole side benefit of open source sort of software is that these people have an interest. The people who make and work on these programs have an interest in its adoption. But they don't get any, and by interest, I mean literally just an interest. Most of them don't get paid for it. They do it because they love it and because they think it's the greatest thing they've ever done. And people like that will talk about their programs and will be very patient with beginners for a long, long time and are very, you know, usually a great resource. I'm very lucky that I have, like, Adrian Holabody, the guy who designed that framework, basically on Instant Messenger all day. Because I have questions about things. But to be honest, like, there are a lot of guys like him out there who are basically constantly available by email or by Instant Messenger or whatever. But if you're going to use a product, learn about sort of the community around that product and try and get involved. Even as a worker, even for those, you know, even if you sign up for one of the email lists or something like that, or visit the bulletin board site and just kind of lurk. And the other thing I would say is you're going to get started. After the initial period of how does this thing actually work at first, have a project or a goal in mind. For instance, if you're going to learn how to use a database and you have to do it at home, learn how to database something you have around the house, like your recipes or something, or schedules or something, but something that you care about. Because the worst thing you can do is you can use the sample database that any software manufacturer provides in their database. Because it's like the only known cure for insomnia. I mean, it's like, I mean, Microsoft has shipped the same sample database for the last 20 years. It's like, come on, people. Don't use sample databases, basically. Build your own. You'll learn more about it, and you'll care more about it. And that way you'll probably learn quicker.
Would you mind just walking us through the recipe bake-off?
Sure.
It was at a table. What did you do?
Let's take a look at Pillsbury. Okay, so the first thing that I wanted to get was I wanted to get information on. Actually, let me do this because my little URL. Baked chicken and spinach stuffing. Okay, so the first thing the reporter showed me was these 100 finalist recipes. Now, let me show you the URL. URLs are very important when you do data work, when it involves the web, because you want to automate stuff as much as possible, and URL is often the best clue as to what is automatable about this. See the end of the URL where it says ?tab=0? Well, that's the first tab, because most computers count from 0, and then you can do tab=1, and tab=2, I think you go up to like 5 or 6. But you basically, those tab numbers correspond to these tabs. Now, one thing computers are ridiculously easy at, good at, and in fact were built for, is to actually count things and loop through them. So I go to the first tab, and I read in that web page, and at first I just want the recipe, the name, and the city and state where the person's from. Because we also wanted to do things as, you know, has there ever been like a repeat winner from the same town? And in fact, there has. Someplace in California. But the other thing about it is, let me just show you a little bit about looking at the page source of this particular page. If you don't look at HTML a lot, you might be forgiven for cringing a whole lot when you see it. But honestly, once you are sick enough like me and you start to look at these things a lot, things start to make sense. At least a little bit. So for instance, up here I have this URL of this little bit right here is a unique ID for that recipe, which is good because that's the German chocolate cream pie. And now I know I can always fetch the recipe at that address. Here's the next recipe, and so on and so forth. So I save that as well. That way I can always get to that. And I automatically have a unique identifier with each recipe. They're not going to do anything like put the same recipe, the two different recipes in the same identifier. And so you grab certain pieces of information.
In programming, or in scripting, or whatever you want to call it, this is generally known as pattern matching. And it's not so far of a leap from Boolean searching as you think it is. It is kind of, it's annoying. Pattern matching is not fun.
The old saying in programming is called regular expressions. They are neither regular nor really very expressive, but it's called regular expressions. And the old saying in programming is that a programmer once had a problem and he thought, aha, I'll use regular expressions. And then he had two problems. So they can be really... there are a lot of people out there who believe that all they need to solve the problems of the world are a scripting language that supports regular expressions and an infinite amount of time. But they'll need that infinite amount of time. But the point of pattern matching is to both spot patterns and capture information within those patterns. And so once you capture it, shoving it off to a database is actually
I'm not explaining this well, but it's actually a fairly easy thing. So you insert stuff into a database just as you would essentially do data entry, step by step. You find something, you match the ID, you capture the ID, and you insert it into a database. You find the name of the recipe, which is conveniently located between these quotes and brackets, and you capture that and insert it into a database. And then the same thing. The name of the person is conveniently located between these two BR tags. And the name of the city and state are also conveniently located between two other BR tags and separated by a comma with a couple of spaces after it. And when you... this is not really easy to start in with. And I realize that, like, for most of you, I'm probably so far off the deep end because I look at things, and the first thing I look for is pattern matching. Like, I don't even read content anymore. I go, ooh, there's all those, you know, it's... there's a sickness to it, I admit. But the same sickness that allowed me to look at this very quickly and say, no, this can be, I can database this. I can make this into a database, and I can do cool stuff with it. And so, once you have that, the basic information, then you can go to the specific recipes, and it's pretty much the same thing. You divvy up in the HTML source, you can, you know, what I ended up doing was I ended up divvying up the number of things, amount of things, from whatever it was. And then I went back and actually stripped out the measurements, like teaspoons, tablespoons, and whatnot. So, but what I ended up with in terms of tables was one table that had the recipe ID, the name of the person, where they were from, the name of the recipe, where the person was from. I had another table that had the recipe ID, which is on the end of this URL. Each URL for each recipe has a ends in the ID number of that recipe. So the second table had the ID, and then it had all the recipes. And so you have like a what you would call sort of a one-to-many relationship in terms of one table that is the master table, and then the recipe, then the ingredient table has all the ingredients. But
why did you strip out the amount of ingredients?
Well, because the reporter was asking questions, or wanted to ask questions such as, how many times has chicken appeared in a winning recipe or in a finalist? And so for me, or for her purposes, the amount wasn't important. And when you're building databases, what you want to get is you want to get fields that contain the most specific information possible. In other words, if your table is ingredients, and you don't care about the measurements,
having the measurements in the same field as the ingredient is messy.
If you were to include the ingredients,
yeah,
because let's say she wanted to know the amount of sodium,
right,
that was in the
right
thing, you would need to convert it all to the same.
I would, exactly, and that would be lots of fun. That would be a lot of fun. Although,
and just hear you say this, the way that I would do that is I would grab the measurement, like 1/2 teaspoon. Let's say my base measurement was going to be tablespoons or teaspoons. Okay, so I grab 2 tablespoons. I would grab that. Pass that to Google, because you ever type 2 tablespoons equals whatever into Google, and it gives you back. Pass that to Google, fetch the result, parse that out into tablespoons and into teaspoons, and then bring back that result. Now, I don't know really exactly how to do that yet, but I know it can be done.
Yeah, you
wouldn't
have to do it one by one.
No, I would do it automatically. You would do it automatically. You would loop through all the ingredients in each of the recipes. And there would be some problems. For instance, like 1 egg. Am I going to convert 1 egg to teaspoons? You know, but it wouldn't be the easiest thing to do. But you could do it, and that's sort of the whole point: is that there are things out there that can be done. You know, it's up to you to determine whether or not you want to spend a week on the Pillsbury Bake Off, which I would argue. And given the story that we ran, it really actually wasn't worth my time.
But it was a cool exercise for me
because it taught me a little bit more about pattern matching and a little bit more about, you know, every time I do this, I get to practice it a little more. So, yeah, I'll give it a shot. I mean, like this kind of stuff, the, you know, the 4 cinnamon crunchy granola bar, 2 pouches, 3/4 cup, I mean, like this would be a nightmare because I already have like 4 or 5 numbers in this thing. So there would be some issues with it. But if I was just looking at, like, sodium, then what I would probably do is load all the stuff and ask for, you know, salt and just isolate on salt. And maybe I'm missing sodium in some other places, but I would probably just do that and not deal with the other ones.
The answer question, that's what I said to you in another recipe thing, but drilling down further, the chicken broth versus chicken breast.
Yes, yes. Well, there's a couple ways to deal with that. One of the ways is you can do liquids versus solids. You can do liquids versus solids in terms of, like, you come up with certain words that if they were present in the ingredient, it would indicate that it was a liquid versus a solid. And then you could have another field that has, like, you know, liquid, solid, things like that. And again, like, that's something that, like, what we do with the Metro database, not to get off the Pillsbury, because I knew it would be a big hit. But literally, that's what I do after I capture the information from the Metro thing is that the description, everything after the time, goes into a single field. And then I populate other fields in the database. There's a field for line that I do an update query in the database that says, if the description contains the word yellow line, put a number, because I have a number, in the line field. If the description field contains the hideously long name of the metro station, put the number of that metro station in the database in this field. And so after the script actually runs and retrieves the information, then I do a bunch of processing and update queries. But that's all in the script. You write that once, and unless they start to roll out new stations, which they may do, that's the only time that I have to really change things. I'm sorry.
So what happens in a few years when they get new database entry
people,
when they start to
use
abbreviations?
Right. No, that's an excellent question. In fact, one of the fun things about Metro is occasionally you find it put on a semicolon instead of a colon. That's fun. I've also found instead of like 12 or 9 a.m., I've also found like 00:09 a.m. There are actually some databases that can handle that. Who go, oh, that's 12:09 a.m. There are some that go, I don't know what that is. Essentially, if that happens, the script will kind of tell me that there's something screwy. It'll check to see, like, every field, is there something in every field? And if it gets an invalid date and can't put anything in that field, it'll notify me. And it'll go, check this one, it has a bad date in it. And then I'll go and I'll check it and I'll go, that might happen again, so I'll hard code it into the script and say, if you find a semicolon where a colon should be, replace it with a colon. So they will make mistakes because they are human. But even so, you can, you know, and yeah, you kind of have to deal with that on a, you know, on a basis. But you don't have to. It doesn't have to be a defeating sort of thing. It's annoying, yeah. But I mean, in terms of maintenance, like, it's probably, I spent like about 10 minutes fixing things that they've done wrong in a year of having this almost.
I was interested in how you categorize the delays, like how they get bound into presidential voter
campaigns. Right. There's a certain syntax that they tend to use, like for instance, unauthorized personal on the tracks becomes person on track. Sick customer. They tend to use, and this is the good thing about getting data that people actually type in. Humans are creatures of habit. They tend to use the same syntax. And in fact, when they don't use the same syntax, sometimes that's a good indication that there's something going on there. For instance,
last year, Metro was not at all hesitant about saying that there was a mechanical problem on the track, or they would call it a track problem. Okay. You'll see that the last incident that said it was as a result of a track problem was in December. That's not because they fixed all the track problems. That's because they stopped using the phrase track problem. Because they realized, hey, this is happening quite a bit. And, you know, because look at all the ones like, you know, from the 5 days leading up to the 21st of December. That's kind of a lot of track problems. Well, that's a little embarrassing. We better kind of hide that. Now, I don't know if exactly how I can say that's exactly how the conversation at Vermont headquarters went, but they stopped using track problem as a description. But we know that now, whereas we wouldn't have known that before. And so maybe that becomes like a line in the story where it's saying, even on their own public website where they disclose issues, they stop describing their problem as a track problem, even though we all know that they continue to have track problems. So mostly I just take it from the description and try to figure out what it might be. Now, there are some that are very popular, like the platform overrun, and the mechanical problem, the door problem, and the sick customer. And there are some that appear only once or twice. And yeah, you could always go back and sort of spend like half an hour sort of check to see like, you know, how many of these are really sort of worthwhile, or to be condensed into other ones. But for the most part, I try not to assign new ones without some cause. Like presidential motorcade had to get its own category, clearly. But sometimes if it says like, you know, the track tie was smoldering, I'll put fire. Because I'm not gonna put smoldering track tie in a category. It's ridiculous.
A question about the person on track information. Is there any way to break out non authorized and authorized people on track?
If there's an authorized person on the track, they don't report it basically. Unless it'll cause a delay, they'll report it as saying they were delayed because of maintenance work on the track. So any person on the track is, at least according to their syntax, is unauthorized.
Derek, how frequently do you just go dumpster diving the data somewhere because you think there might be a story in something as opposed to working with a reporter on something going off to support their needs?
More often than I like to admit. Less now that I have a baby, but there are all sorts of fun little things you can do. In fact, even with a baby, like this weekend, I was a little bored. I found that, for instance, how many folks use Delicious? Anyone? Everyone? If you don't know about Delicious, there are other sites as well. Pearl is a good one and stuff. But I, let's see, where did it go here? I found one this weekend, Arlington.
Arlington, Virginia, their county police department does a wonderful, wonderful thing. They have crime reports dating back to 2002 on their site by day. This I can scrape and put into the database without a problem. And in fact, they make it easier for you when they bold stuff because that's an extra tag. And stolen autos. This is going to be a popular database. I can already tell. Stolen auto, they give me the tag number for crying out loud. And the make any year. Now, who isn't going to want to click on the website and be like, okay, what are they stealing in Arlington these days? You know, every person owns a car in Arlington and visits our website, once we get this up there, they'll visit that. So, and who knows, maybe we get a story out. Maybe the cops reporter in Arlington, maybe the police in Arlington don't even know which cars. I mean, they probably do, but they're not going to tell us all the time. Well, they're telling us. We just have to figure out actually how to make sense of it. So a good bit of the time.
This is more a tools question than a content question, but I get mistaken for a geek a lot, but really, I'm not a geek. The reason why I know I'm not a geek is because I can't fix anything when it breaks.
Yeah, but you have a laptop in front of you right now. Here's the thing. I don't really fix things either. I mean,
I'm wondering about you. You have some great-looking tools, but I'm wondering what happens.
What happens when things break?
When things break.
Yeah, sometimes you do have to like spend some time. I mean, my goal is to reduce the amount of time I actually spend doing manual work, and that includes long work, by the way. But I mean, manual work of pretty much any kind. But when people come to me with computer questions, like, oh, this broke or that broke, like if I can't tell them the answer in 5 seconds, I'll be like, call IT. Because it's not really, one, we shouldn't.
I know we get this a lot because we're the friendliest people who know anything about computers in the industry. But unless you have some sort of like little knowledge base or frequently asked questions that you can look up, it's almost always a waste of your time. Unless the person asks a question that you can then turn around and get them and to, you know, you can pull them in like the mob, you know, and be like, okay, but I own you now. And here's what we're going to do.
Depending on the person, if you pick the right spot and the right person, that can work out for you. I think we're about over time, but I mean, unless.
You have that job question, which is having versus being requested.
The luxury of my position is that people do come to me a lot and can approach me a lot, but it's usually the same people, or a lot of the same people, which is fine by me. I am there to serve the entire newsroom, but there are people there who do not want to be served, or do not want to be helped, or who, quite frankly, helping is not really even an option. They're beyond help. And so, I may give it a try, but there are some folks who I probably will never work with at the Washington Post, not just because it's a big organization. But most of the time, they come to me, I would say. But there are times when I just go out and look for data that is local, usually, or sports-related. Because I know I can find audiences for local and sports-related content. The other thing was the Congressional Votes Database that we launched last year. Like, I went looking for that because I worked at Congressional Quarterly, and I had one there. And I went to the Washington Post, and I didn't have it anymore, and I was pissed off about that.
It's
pretty vague. It's getting a little bit better, but it's usually pretty vague. Like, I know there's stuff out there, or I don't know there's stuff out there. I suspect there are things out there. But that doesn't bother me at all if it's really vague, because quite frankly, then it's probably a good opportunity to, one, learn about it. If I don't know about it, I'll learn about the data set. And two, to say, okay, well, you're kind of being, you know, this isn't going to work for you. We did a series. Metro is our perpetual whipping boy at the Post for the past, like, 20 months or so. And we did a big series last year, and we just beat up on them a lot. But they wanted to use, like, this federal transit database. Except that if you talk to the federal transit administrator people, they'll basically tell you that a lot of it is crap. If you were from Philadelphia, like the SEPTA people, I don't know what they're smoking or drinking when they send their data to the feds, because it just isn't, like, it doesn't make any sense. And even the feds are like, yeah, we don't trust them at all. But they put the data out there. And so, you know, there's a lot of that that goes on where reporters say, ooh, this looks good. And a lot of my job is kind of saying, well, does it? Is it really good, or is it not good? But generally, unless they've been using that data set for a while, they aren't very specific. The Metro incident thing, I just did because I was annoyed at having to look at that web page every day. It was like, or not every day, but I'd be delayed on a train getting home. And I'd be like, why was that? And I'd look and I'd see it and I go, well, this is stupid for me to go back. I should be notified. I should, I shouldn't have to do anything. And then you build it.
Are you doing something for the Katrina anniversary with data? Are you getting some raw data from somewhere?
Well, not really that I know of. The other issue about working at a place like the Post is that I have no idea what goes on in most of the departments at any given time. Or at least I have a vague idea. But
you anticipate that?
There should be a lot of need for that. But frankly, the New York Times has been kicking our rear on data that's involved in Katrina. We do very excellent. We've done very excellent coverage, I think. Data-wise, New York Times has been killing us. Because the SBA runs a lot of the emergency assistance things, payments down there, and they went and got that database. And then they went down and did a survey of people where they went out and just found people. And, there was a couple. And then they went out and tried to track the deaths, and they did it by hand. It's pretty impressive work. So we haven't done as much as we could or should do. Yeah.
How much of the data are you getting online now, and how often do you get data versus a file?
Like probably like 75-80% of my data I get off the web. And then 15% I probably get emailed to me or sent on a CD. I consider data entry to be a failure. Like if you've lost. If you have to resort to data entry, it's bad. But sometimes you do have to resort to that.
Historical stuff.
Right. Particularly historical stuff. We just had to do that. But if it's on the web, I try to make every effort to get it that way. Even if I know it's available as a database from an agency, like if it's on the web, I'll try and get it that because it's easier and quicker and less hassle than me dealing with the department.
How many databases do you have automatically updating right now?
All right. The campaign finance database is updated automatically. There's three of those. Metro database, crime databases. There actually are a couple crime databases that do update automatically. I'd say probably about a dozen, all told. But many of them are not used frequently. And many of them are updated like once a week or once a month. Not every day. Very few of them are updated every day. Once a week or once a month is more regular. And you'll find actually that's the case, is that, even if it's the coolest database alive, like very frequently will be updated every single day. Sometimes it is, but you can get a lot of cool stuff from stuff that's released every quarter or even every year, just as long as. And I would automate stuff, even if it's released every year, just so that in case you get hit by a loss.
On the loss of the situation,
is anything available before the speech run? In other words, if you're a user organization, has people competing, maybe doing different aspects of the story, who might benefit from the loss of information?
Well, we're a very friendly newsroom with the Washington Post, so we share an awful lot.
We actually are a very collegial newsroom, I would say, more than I thought that we might be when I first went there. But, no. Generally speaking, if the wiki's locked beforehand, unless somebody comes and says, you should let this person have the password, they're working on this story as well. And that does happen.
Okay.
So
the reporters can work with each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But really what I'd like to do, ideally, is to have them basically be in charge of their own little area. And say, here's your wiki, here's a little bit about how to post stuff to it now, run off and play. And we've got one that's like 200 and some pages. We've got another one that's rapidly approaching 150 pages. Because usually once they get hooked, they get really, really. I get messages on weekends saying, I think the server rebooted it because the wiki's down. Can you restart it? And I'm like, I'm with my family someplace else. But yeah, okay. But they get really sort of, they get into it, which is good because I don't have to deal with it. If they're bugging me about the fact that the wiki's down, like, I'm not going to complain about that.
Have you worked with your online people to put some of your data?
Yes. Yes.
Check on
It's a hit and miss, but it does pretty well in some respects. When we did the votes database, the congressional votes database, we did that with the intent that it would be an online, a web project, mainly, first, really. And in fact, it was really funny because I went to one of the people in the newsroom and I showed this to him right before it went live. And the gentleman said to me, "Why are you making this public?" And I said, "Don't worry, no one will look at it." It's literally another editor said to me also, "What if someone uses this data to do a story?" I said, come on, you know reporters, everybody, you know
everything. Miami Herald did a piece using our data over the weekend, actually.
And it happens, like, every couple months we see a piece that's based on our data, and that's great. Front page of Miami Herald, they're citing us. Can't beat that. I mean, when does that really happen? It doesn't really happen. So, but we designed this, and that would involve, like, Adrian and I working on it, the website guy and I working on it together. And that was a really great process, and I encourage you to find someone that you can work with at your website. Just do it, because it's fun, and you learn an awful lot about how things work. You really do. Yes?
Did you flash that one of your
panels? Oh, yeah.
Wait a second. Actually, since I'm on my other laptop, it might be a little tricky, but let me see. Well, not my other laptop. I've now taken Jessica's laptop from her. That's very nice. Let me see what I can do here. Let me see if I have something. Oh, yeah, okay. This is probably going to look kind of ugly, but... And we're probably, like, what, way over time? Yes? Great. Let me try and find something that's... let's see here. Okay. A couple of years ago, I got really, really bored with... I used to cover campaign finance a lot, and I wish I could forget more than I know about campaign finance. But I got bored with visiting the FTC's website every day to find their press releases, because I just got bored. And I said, no, they're going to send them to me now. And I made a little RSS feed out of their press release list, which is just a big reverse chronological list of press releases. And I grab the top 10, put them into a feed. The feed stuff is a little more, makes this a little more complicated than things are, but literally. And when I said it was in English, I didn't mean non-technical English. I just meant English, but I mean it is sort of basically in English. And I just quickly sort of go through, and the purple stuff is notes, documentation, essentially. Which everybody who writes scripts should do all of that account, but receiving that account sign as well. So that URL there is what I fetch, and then I open up the file that I'm going to write my file to. And then I try to read the URL, the content of the URL, and unless there's like a problem with that, in which case it puts out an error, it goes ahead and proceeds with the file. This XML at the top here is just simply the stuff you have to put at the top of an XML file. And then, here's the regular expression, which is what makes most people roll their eyes back in their heads and fall over, because it's a bunch of gobbledygook. But mostly, if you've seen HTML before, a lot of it is just HTML tags and then the stuff in between. These parentheses are what is containing the information that I'm capturing.
and I'm capturing the date, and I'm capturing the URL, and I'm capturing the title of the press release. And then there's a lot of white space, because they're bad, crappy designers, and like two spaces where there should be one, and so I get rid of that. That was something I added later. At first, it wasn't a problem, it was a little unsightly. So then I find all the patterns for this matches in the page that I've read, and I say, that's called matches. All the list of my matches is called matches. I try to use things like this so I don't confuse myself. Then I say, but I only want the first 10 matches. Okay, matches now equals the first 10 matches. And then I unpack that list of matches by looping through it, and I say, for each time there's a date, a link, and a title in that match, I convert the date so it's an actual literal date. When they talked about validating feeds and whatnot yesterday, you don't even want to get involved in like what is pure XML and valid RSS, because these people are unholy. But I mean, seriously, like there's a long-standing war over what RSS is and isn't. I mean, like it's sick. You can waste hours reading that. But anyway, I humor them and convert it to a valid date, and then I write out the rest of the RSS feed by inserting the valid date, the title, URL, which I then make relative, which I make like, because the URL that they present is a, it doesn't begin with HTTP, it just begins with a slash, so it's a relative URL. And so I provide a flat end of the rest of the URL. And then what happens is it comes out and it writes all that out to a feed and closes the feed. And then that is an RSS feed, which was last updated. Well, it runs every morning, so you get, now I get like, okay, June 9th, they just filed the first link, and there's the link, and I click on it. And now I don't have to visit that website ever again, or that page ever again. So yeah, a lot of work on the front end, but until they change their, basically they have to change the script once a year to replace the, and to be honest, I can even automate that. I'd say, tell me what year it is. Okay. Python's pretty good at doing things like telling you what year it is. So it's just what I did literally, as you can see from the top here, it says originally based on a script by Sam Ruby. So I took his script off his website, and literally I removed the parts that he was working, like the specific topic he was working on, and I put in my URL and my stuff. I mean, literally. When I say steal from the best, if you don't know what you're doing, follow what other people who look like they do know what they're doing, and literally take their stuff out, put your stuff in, and run.
Your thoughts are Jessica,
no. So, on the other hand, I give him credit. I think that counts for something. But, Python is just such a cool little language. And yep, you have it. See? Everybody has it. And it just does lots of fun little things. You can do math with it, Okay, hey, great, math. But you can do all sorts of fun things with it. And it's a very useful and flexible language. And there are lots and lots of tutorials at python.org if you ever started. I'm not going to say anything bad about Perl and PHP, which are other languages. Very powerful. Perl has been around forever. It's a very powerful language. In fact, the whole pride of Perl is that there are 15 ways you can do something in Perl, which I don't see as good necessarily, but the Perl guys love it. So there are lots of different ways paths that you can go. And you basically have to, my advice if you're ever going to get into this area is pick what you like and stick with it. And who cares about what other folks use? Okay, so I should probably release you from your conclusion. Thank you very much. Since I always like to talk after the applause, my website is thescoop.org, and there will be a link later on today to a little handout I have which describes some of the tools that I went through. Apache, MySQL, the rest of it. So it'll be, that link will be on scoop.org later on today. Thanks for coming.
That was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Oh, you are the best in the last years at it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.